Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to this edition of News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Few North Carolinians have a more thorough grasp of the issues that confront the children of North Carolina than Whitney Tucker, the research director for the children's advocacy nonprofit, NC Child. Recently, Tucker was kind enough to join me for a special extended interview in which she discussed a pair of important recent reports released by her organization. In part one of our discussion, we discussed a report entitled The Child Welfare Impact of the Opioid Epidemic. Make no mistake, the impact is significant. Statewide parental substance misuse was a contributing factor to children entering foster care in 39% of cases in fiscal year 2016-17, a 50% increase since 2007-2008. Well, Whitney Tucker, welcome to News and Views. Thanks for being back with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You've been pretty prolific lately. You guys are cranking out a lot of reports at NC Child, and it's important stuff that you're talking about. One of the more important recent reports is something called The Child Welfare Impact of the Opioid Epidemic. And, you know, this is something probably a lot of people haven't even thought about. We're increasingly, Americans are aware that there is this thing, this terrible epidemic afflicting so many parts of our country. But we think about the people who are actually hooked on opioids. We don't really think about often the broader impact. Talk to us about your report.
Sure. So in terms of motivations, I guess we could just start with the foundation that children's well-being depends on the well-being of their families and their communities. So when something like the opioid epidemic comes up and it's devastating families, it's devastating communities, it stands to reason that it's also devastating kids and that we need to be able to document that. So this report was just one way to kind of look at that issue from a different lens. Essentially, what I did was look back at some HHS data on childhood entry into foster care, into our numbers and our rates across the state, and then looked at that over the same period of time that we've seen increased hospitalizations and opioid use deaths.
And those numbers are way up in North Carolina.
Yes. Yes. The hospitalizations and the overdose deaths have gone way up over the past few years. I think in the report, I note some of the things from the HHS action plan, some of the data points that they found. And one of them was that there were nearly 8,500 prescriptions for opioids that were dispensed over the same period of time that there were also three North Carolinians dying each day from opioid overdose between 2015 and 16. And then for every opioid poisoning death, there were just under three hospitalizations, four emergency department visits due to medication and drug overdose, and 380 people who reported misusing prescription pain relievers. So, I mean, that epidemic is just, you know, it's insane. And it's really reaching far and wide across the state. And over the same period of time, we're seeing more and more kids who are going into foster care with parental substance misuse as a reason for their entry.
I guess that makes sense. What's happening is the parents become effectively, if they're not in the hospital, they're incapacitated by this terrible addiction.
Sure. So
they're not going to work, I presume.
In some cases, they try. Yeah. Right. So not all parents who are suffering from an opioid or other substance use addiction are out of work, but it really compromises their ability to consistently prioritize the needs of the child. And so over time, we have seen that more and more people start to notice these ill effects on a child. A report is made. And then when it's investigated, if the child is taken from the home, not only are we seeing more kids staying, but we're seeing that kids who have entered foster care are staying longer than they have in recent years. And also, lots of research is showing that those kids are more likely to then later on in their lives develop substance use addiction themselves, that they are more likely to have issues with concentration and learning, that they are more likely to have trouble developing trusting relationships. And all of that has an impact not only on that kid and on that, you know, developing adult, but then later on our society at large, right? And it causes us increased costs, I mean, as a society, outside of the, you know, emotional and behavioral costs, but, you know, economic costs in terms of criminal justice, in terms of healthcare usage, and in terms of our education spending.
Did I read in the report, maybe I read this incorrectly, that in some instances where a child might be placed with an uncle or an aunt, sometimes even these opioid epidemics are so pernicious that they affect the broader family, and it can't even put them with the uncle and the aunt because they too are struggling with
it. Yes. So there have been some news reports around the state that in some places where folks try to place a child if they're going to go into foster care with a family member first, because there's a lot of research that says that children have better outcomes in that situation. But across the state, what they're finding is that in some of these places, the opioid epidemic has spread so far that when a parent is incapacitated, they'll reach out to a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, and they'll also be struggling with substance use. And so there's no one within the immediate family to essentially take over care of that child, and they have to go into foster care with a stranger.
So talk to us about our foster care system. There's lots of wonderful human beings doing amazing work in the foster care system, but am I right to say that it's an imperfect system, that there are many struggles that North Carolina faces in maintaining an adequate foster care system?
Certainly. So I am no expert in the foster care system, and I will preface with that, but our foster care system has been struggling. We're seeing rising caseloads for caseworkers, and we're also seeing that as these more and more kids end up staying in care longer, some of them in part due to the opioid epidemic, right, as parents are going through this treatment struggle that is often they get clean and then they kind of backslide and have a lot of struggles with addiction, that is leading to increased costs in foster care as well, right, because we're keeping kids longer than we ever had to, and that we need more and more foster families than we needed before. And so the system is certainly overburdened, and it was struggling already, I think, as, you know, NCFAST is being implemented as well. NCFAST is a data system that is going to help streamline the way that counties talk to each other, essentially, in the data so that they can track kids across counties and that every county is collecting the same measures. It's supposed to help a lot, but, I mean, with any new system, as you implement
growing
it, there's going to be a lot of growing pains, right? And so that's happening at the same time as this opioid epidemic and at the same time as a lot of the other struggles that families have always had, right? And, you know, our foster care system is trying to react to all of those at the same time, and it's really struggling.
And I didn't want this to be all about foster care, but another point that's probably worth mentioning is that even when someone successfully gets through the foster care system, sometimes kids are in it all the way up until they're age 18. There's a gap there that some nonprofits are now having to step up to address, because a lot of kids aren't ready for life at 18 when they say, okay, well, foster care is over. Have a good life.
Absolutely. One of the teens that we actually quoted in our press release for this report is affiliated with the group Say So, which is with a lot of foster care youth and youth who used to be in foster care. And she was actually in foster care until she turned 18. And when we sat down and talked, she just really could not impress on me enough that if there were a way to have helped her mother to keep her in her custody before then, that she would have preferred that, because, you know, essentially these kids are just kids. And when they reach 18, we don't have enough resources to support them within the system anymore.
What are some things that we might could do to address this? Obviously, the problem of opioids is there's no way to just snap your fingers and make it go away. It's a huge crisis that our society faces. But I mean, there are some things I think that you highlight in your report that North Carolina could do to make addiction services available to people. How do we go about doing that? What are some options?
Certainly. So in the report, we really highlight closing the health insurance coverage gap as a measure that can really help a lot of families in North Carolina. The reason being that parents really need treatment services so that they can heal from substance use disorders. So that's opioids and all substances. And without it, they're at high risk of death due to overdose, and they're much less likely to retain or regain the ability to provide that stable, nurturing environment for their kids. And also, we've seen in other states, especially since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, when they expanded Medicaid, that they saw a humongous uptick in the number of people who were using that expanded health care coverage to get these behavioral health and substance use disorder treatment. And so we know that from other states' experiences that if we were to expand healthcare coverage to 138% of the federal poverty level, that we could help not every family, right? That this isn't going to solve the opioid crisis, but it could certainly open up treatment to a lot of families who are unable to afford it right now. And a lot of parents who, like I was saying earlier, are working right now, you know, and trying to make ends meet while also struggling with these addictions, right? And so if we're able to give them any avenue to the care that could help them to overcome substances while they still have children in their possession or in their homes, and that they can keep their families together, then we should do that.
I mean, think about it. If you yourself were struggling with an addiction problem, really the only option for many of these people right now is just tough it out, figure it out on your own. Because if you don't have health insurance, if you don't have the means to get some sort of care, some sort of counseling, some kind of therapy, I mean, it's just an impossible burden. And we can have moral debates about, you know, how this problem arose. But the hard practical reality is that these people need help. And unless they have health insurance to pay for it, they're not going to get it. That's why you propose expanding Medicaid
Exactly. Like I said, it's not a silver bullet, right? But it is something that is on the table right now that we could move on right now that could help a lot of families. In 2014, I think the estimate was 144,000 North Carolinians who had incomes that were below that threshold of 138% of the federal poverty level, so they would be eligible if we were to expand. And then they also had a mental health or substance use disorder diagnosis, right? So we know that there are about 144,000 North Carolinians right now who are struggling with this, and Medicaid offers the best chance nationwide, but also in North Carolina, for low-income parents to access otherwise prohibitively expensive treatments. And also, it gives comprehensive services for children who are affected by parental addiction. So that's an important offshoot as well.
Well, Whitney, let's move on to a discussion of the latest big report from NC Child, which is the Kids Count Data Book. Talk to us about this. This is a big report y'all put out every year, am I right?
Yes. So the Kids Count Data Book is actually a publication of the Kids Count National Organization, which is a subsidiary of the Annie Casey Foundation. And NC Child is the North Carolina State grantee for Kids Count. So we release this report along with a Kids Count affiliate in every other state every single year. And it talks about child well-being in four large domains of well-being, and then four indicators within each domain. So for a total of 16, those domains are economic well-being, health, education, and family and community, which really gives you a sense of those other kind of more amorphous indicators of child well-being that are outside of, say, school or outside of the economy, but still have a big impact on kids, you know, functioning and support.
We know for a fact that the nation is in economic recovery. It's a very uneven recovery that's not distributed across our various income groups very well. We see growing gaps, but it's fair to say that we are in a national economic recovery. North Carolina has generally been a part of that, or at least large parts of North Carolina have been a part of it. Is it doing any good? Are we seeing any help from that?
It is, and you've actually given a pretty succinct summary of what the data book shows for North Carolina this year, honestly. We're seeing that a stronger economy is producing better outcomes for kids, but that economic recovery hasn't made its way to all the areas of concentrated poverty across the state. And so our overall ranking compared to other states on all these same indicators is 32nd, which, you know, isn't great, but isn't terrible. Could technically be worse, but the funding through federal supports, things like WIC and SNAP and TANF, all of that has helped to contribute to this success that we've seen in improving a lot of indicators.
Derisively get referred to as welfare programs.
Right.
With women and infant children, what used to be called food stamps, SNAP and TANF,
exactly.
Which used to be called AFDC. These are the programs that provide some minimal amounts of income support. Even these, they've been greatly reduced over the years, but even in their present diminished state, you're seeing that they still make an impact.
Absolutely, and that they have really helped to increase our rankings in some of these domains. And we'll see that when we talk about specific indicators that we've done better in. Overall, I will say that we've improved from previous years in multiple areas of child well-being. Right. Generally, there's been an increase in indicators that in the Kids Count Network we call family stability indicators. So things like economic stability, that sort of thing. So we see 12% fewer kids living in poverty from 2010 to 2016. But that's still 22% of our kids that we have in the state living in poverty, about 490,000 kids as of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So most of the data points in this year's data book are 2016 points.
Got it.
We've also seen a 17% decrease in kids living in families with unemployed parents. So that's where both parents are not employed full time year round. And that is a good sign, right? Because that means that more income is probably coming into households, that kids are more able to afford basic needs, right? So we see that as a family stability indicator and something that's good. But even with that decrease, we're still at 29% of kids who live in households where both parents aren't employed.
Wow.
And I say both, but that means that the parents in the household. Right. So in a single parent household, that is still just one parent. We've seen a 26% decline in children living in unaffordable housing. So housing where the family is spending more than 30% of their income on that housing. That is great. We're still seeing that that's 28% of kids who still live in that circumstance, right?
Yeah. So good news, but a heck of a long way to go.
Right. It's difficult in this state because we've made such incredible strides, but we still have so far to go on a lot of these indicators. We are seeing fewer teens, 16 to 19, who are considered disconnected youth. Hmm. So that's teenagers who are not in school or working. 16 to 19, that's 30% fewer over this time period. And now we're down to 7%.
great.
Means we're doing that, and that's fantastic because that is a measure of our economy and how it's preparing kids to enter the workforce and to enter college and that sort of thing, right? So that's great that we're seeing more kids who are, you know, getting into those supportive environments that can help them to find ways to support themselves and eventually support families, which is great. We're also seeing just, you know, this measure is not necessarily an indicator of child well-being overall, but it is an indicator of family stability. We're seeing 3% fewer children living in single-parent families, which has now gotten us down to 36% of kids living in single-parent families in the state, which seems high, but the national average is about 35. So we've actually made strides on that. And I will just, you know, say that obviously lots of people grow up in single-parent families and they have positive outcomes and things turn out great for them. But a lot of research does show that kids do best in a family where they have two supportive parents who are able to provide for them and provide care. And so we are excited to see that that's happening at the same time as this economic recovery, because it's looking like kids are getting more holistic supports.
That's very encouraging.
Right. But as we've seen all of that, we've also seen 8% more children who are living in high poverty areas. So that's census tracts where the entire tract has greater than or equal to 30% of poverty. So 30% of families living at the poverty level. Right. And so economic recovery then isn't being even across the states. There's this 12% decrease in poverty overall, but an 8% increase in kids living in concentrated poverty. So kids who are already poor, there are more kids who are getting even poorer, right? Those areas are growing. And so there's something that is being missed in this sort of trickle down of economic recovery. It's not trickling down to all the families, right? So now 13% of kids in the state live in high poverty areas.
Which is appalling. Any other areas in which you think maybe we're falling short that we need to do better in?
Overall, another message is just that progress is being made in education, but it is still obviously a priority need area. We've seen a 36% decrease in high school students who are not graduating on time, which is fantastic. We're down to 14% now, which we obviously want to get down to zero, but that is an incredible change over time. We've seen a 10% decrease in the percentage of fourth graders who are not proficient in reading, and that's on a national assessment of educational progress. So that's the same across all of the states, so that this indicator is comparable to other kids count states. But that's still 61% of kids. But progress is progress, right?
We'll take it.
however, at the same time that we've seen that, we've seen a 2% increase in the percentage of eighth graders who are not proficient in math. So we're seeing fourth graders getting better at reading, eighth graders having worse outcomes in math. And then also a 2% increase in young children. So that's 3- and 4-year-olds who are not enrolled in any type of school. And that's important because we know that that start at 3 and 4 years old in school has a big impact on a child's opportunity for success later in life. And that high quality early education can really make a difference in a child's life, and that the sooner we get them into that high quality while their brain is developing and getting all those synapses that are just making those connections early on in life, the better off that child will be. So we want to see that get better over time. Also, just generally in the health domain, we're continuing to struggle with healthy births in North Carolina. And with that said, our health score overall, our domain ranking is 29th in health, right, compared to other states, right? But that's because we have one of the worst low birth weight babies rates. So we have 9.2% low birth weight babies in North Carolina. We're the 43rd in the country on that particular indicator. But we've also seen a 42% decline in the teen birth rate. So now there are only 22 births per 1,000 females per ages 15 to 19, which is fantastic. And we're seeing that happen all over the country, but that's having a big impact on our score here in North Carolina. It's kind of helping to tip the scales. Some research is indicating that might be due to the increased use of long-acting contraceptives. And others have also pointed to some TV shows like Teen Mom on MTV having an impact on teenagers, you know, feelings about early engagement. And then also 96% of kids in the state have health insurance now.
Thanks to state action, intentional state action, the Children's Health Insurance Program.
That's policy change and largely the Affordable Care Act on the national scale, right? So now that a lot of kids are mandated to have health care, we've gotten down to, you know, only 4% who don't. And that's been a 50% decline in uninsured children from 2010 to 2016, which is insane.
Our time is limited, but there's one other issue I know you want to talk about and I want to hear about, which is the census and the upcoming 2020 census and just the whole issue of how we even do this counting of kids. This kids count report is vitally important, but Sometimes we run into roadblocks in even getting the numbers we need to know where we stand.
Sure. So the theme of this year's Kids Count Data Book is the 2020 census, and that is because a lot of the success that we have seen in North Carolina and a lot of the success that other states have seen in increasing their rankings has been due to federal supports, right? And so the money that we get in from the federal government being put into these programs that we talked about earlier that really support kids, like SNAP and WIC and TANF, those sort of things are really helping kids to do better over time. But we have an estimated 73,000 kids in North Carolina who stand to not be counted in the 2020 census. They live in what are known as hard to count census tracts. And so those are often high poverty. Those are often tracts with a lot of renters, migrant households, also households that are, you know, have difficult family structure. So maybe it's the mother's household, but her daughter and her daughter's child live with her. You know, who gets counted on the census form? Those sort of complications lead to a lot of kids being undercounted. And in the last census, North Carolina had the eighth highest undercount of any state. And that has a big impact on our federal funding because a lot of the funding that comes down from the federal level depends on the number of kids who are counted in each state. And so in North Carolina, we stand to lose about $5 billion in federal program funding if we don't get this right.
So what do we do? What, is there any hope for fixing this situation?
So there is. We can encourage our lawmakers to fully support census efforts at the state and local level. Right. And so that includes Get Out the Count commissions. That includes employing more enumerators. So people who go to door to door and knock during the census, employing more of those from the local communities who are able to know, you know, where people really do live, where they don't, who lives in that household, who can kind of help to spot some issues before they might come up. And then also doing some federal advocacy to ensure that the census gets a director. Right. That the Census Bureau now gets a director to get them on track and that they get full funding that they need, because right now the requests have been denied and they've been getting partial funding and partial funding. And we've already had to cut two of three national tests of the census. And so now the only one that we're having is in Providence, Rhode Island. And also pushing back against things like a citizenship question on the census, because that sort of question, a lot of research is saying that that's going to push a lot of families to not answer it at all, right? Due to fear of retribution in some form from the federal government. And that is not what's best for kids and families. If those families don't speak up for, you know, maybe really relevant reasons, right? What we're going to see is that the kids who are not going to be counted are going to be the ones who stand to gain the most from these federal programs and federal supports that we need.
Yeah. So the bottom line, census, good. Participate in the census. Support programs that aid the census because it brings federal dollars to our state. It allows our government to operate as it's supposed to. And
absolutely.
To the extent we're not participating in it, we're doing a great disservice to our families and children.
Absolutely.
Wow. Your report is chock full of incredibly important information. The Kids Count Data Book on North Carolina. Find it at nchild.org. Whitney Tucker, thank you for all you do for this important cause for children. And please keep up the good work. We'll do this again soon.
Thank you so much. Always glad to be here.
Up next, a look at the issue of employment equity in rural North Carolina. Stay with us.